Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politilo.
And Katie Godden from The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. This week, we're exploring learning workflows. I'm delighted to welcome Paul Matthews to the podcast. Thank you for joining us, Paul. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit more about you?
Oh, yes. Well, welcome. That's great to be here. And a little bit about me. It's always a difficult question. How far back do you want to go? I guess I started life as an engineer. So I came into the L&D world with that kind of background of sort of wondering, you know, what's wrong? How do we fix it? And that's led to a lot of different thinking around L&D, probably compared to many people who have been in L&D all their lives. So, and since that time, I've written three books in the area, which have been, you know, published and a couple of them in reprint. Written a lot of magazines, spoken at conferences, and my thinking's moved on over the years from what I used to do 20 years ago in L&D to what's happening now. Quite honestly, if I look back on what I used to do 20 years ago, I kind of shudder a little bit. So it's interesting to see how I've evolved, but also how thinking has evolved generally in the sector.
Cool, that's great. So Paul, you're here to talk to us today about learning workflows and why they're so important. So lots of our listeners would have heard about learning in the flow of work and working workflow learning. Is the term learning workflow just another way of saying the same thing?
It's not, in my opinion. I don't know whether I coined the term. I've certainly been using it for quite a few years. And I first started talking about a learning workflow in my book on learning transfer, because I started there, obviously, I was researching, looking at if you're going to deliver some kind of training intervention or training course, how do you make sure it gets operationalized and turned into, you know, real performance changes and real changes on the job? And it became very obvious that in order to do that, people were going to have to go and do a number of activities over a period of time in order to become habitual about their new behavior, in order to embed it and make it sustainable. And as soon as you talk about a number of activities that are planned over a period of time, by definition, that's a workflow. And clearly, if you develop a workflow, a sequence of activities over time that has a learning or a behavioral type outcome, well, let's just call it a learning workflow. So when I talk about a learning workflow, I mean that sequence of activities. So it's an entity that's designed and it has a purpose, it has an endpoint, it has an outcome that's desired. Whereas learning in the workflow, or workflow learning, or just out there at your desk learning stuff as you do stuff, it's much more haphazard, coincidental. It's very valuable, and a lot of learning happens that way, but it's not the same as what I'm talking about here. So we do need to kind of disambiguate those terms a bit. I love that word, disambiguate. So I got the chance to use it. Woohoo! So that's why a learning workflow to me is an entity. It's a thing we design, we do on purpose. Whereas learning in the workflow is a lot more haphazard. It happens. It's just almost like a side effect of doing the work.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're picking up on a couple of points there. So if we, you know, you talk about, you know, learning in the flow of work, and the people who've talked about that extensively, but that can be as much of a culture and the availability of material. So you've got just-in-time learning, you've got proper performance support, or whatever it happens to be. And that's more about creating that environment where it can be haphazard, but it can also be creating that need of, you know, you've got a reference material or sources or tools or support that is available, can be trusted, and will help you to solve what you're doing, and also people contribute to that. But to me, it sounds like you're talking about something that is more akin to, you know, that I want to get from A to B, or there's a purpose to this learning, and there's an outcome that the learning designer has, or, you know, the learning professional is putting together. So in terms of thinking about those things, so, you know, is it a learning pathway, is it a learning workflow? You know, what's the difference for those people who are used to developing pathways of learning in their role? What is the difference?
Well, I think you're quite right that it's fundamentally different to that learning that happens, you know, from a performance support system or something. And of course, the goal of those is to help people do their job. If they happen to learn something alongside using that performance support system, that's great. But they don't necessarily have to, because they can use the same performance support system again tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, and of course, what they learn while they're doing that, there's kind of not a lot of control over that, in the sense that you can put those materials there. But they will learn what they learn. And the other thing, of course, is if they don't have those materials, that performance support, they'll end up learning how to get by without them, which might not be ideal. So there's this whole idea of we're not sure what we're getting when the learning's just happening out there in the workflow in that kind of, well, it side effect type way. And then you're also right in that when I talk about a learning workflow as an entity, I am definitely talking about something that's purposeful and designed. And it is different to what you might call a content pathway or a sequence of bits of material to go and learn in a sequence, which is what you can do on many LMSs, for example. You can say, you know, here are these particular resources, go and visit them in this order and go through them. But that's still just literally a whole bunch of content delivered, not one event, but perhaps several, but still a very kind of event-based. The navigation or the journey you mentioned is also a nice analogy. I sometimes use the sat-nav analogy. There's four things you've got to have in place in order for a sat-nav to work. You've got to know where you are now, obvious. You've got to know where you want to get to, also pretty obvious. You've then got to have some turn-by-turn instructions to get from where you are now to where you want to be. And those are designed, usually sat-nav, obviously, it's an AI that does that design for us. And then, of course, the fourth thing that has to be in place is you have to actually follow the instructions or you're not going to get there. So the driver has to do what they're told from those instructions. So those four things need to be there. And the same basic four parameters or four critical success factors need to be in place for a learning workflow. You've got to have an idea of where you're at right now behaviorally. You've got to have a pretty good idea and clarity over where you want to get to behaviorally. You then need to design those turn-by-turn instructions to get people from where they are currently to where you want them to be. And then you need to be able to ensure that they follow those instructions. In other words, they hold them accountable in some way for doing those turn-by-turn instructions that will take them from their current set of behaviors to that new design set of behaviors. So a lot of the learning workflow stuff is actually enabling you to stitch those four things together. And then you will get success. Because pretty obviously, if you know where you are, you know where you're going, you've got a set of steps that are well designed to get you there and people follow those steps, you're guaranteed to get to that endpoint. You know, you never, you know, log into your sat nav and expect not to get there.
Well, I think, you know, taking that sat nav analogy and some of Katie's journeys this week, you know, I think having that rerouting ability as well is important as things change and, you know, people react differently to the learning. Sure. So, you know, that almost personalizes and reacts to the situation. So I can see all of that flowing through. How do you create those learning workflows, Paul?
You've got to start with the end in mind. I mean, let's get back to our pretty standard thing from Stephen Covey. And the end in mind is the set of behaviors that you want that learning workflow to deliver for you. So what we're really talking about is not delivering content, which is what a lot of L&D people get wrapped up with, is we're talking about delivering behaviors. So the first step in any kind of learning workflow creation is to know the end game, know the end point. What are the behaviors that we want to happen? And as you define that, you'll clearly also be thinking about, well, why aren't they happening now? What's going on at the present? So that definition of where we are now and where you want to be tend to come together as we define, well, people need to be doing this or not doing this, or this is where we're at the moment and that's not working. So we need to do something different. What do we want to do instead? So it's all of these sorts of questions. I call this a behavioral needs analysis. Or a BNA. There's a new acronym for you to add to the encyclopedia of three-letter acronyms as a BNA or a behavioral needs analysis. And that involves certainly some performance and task diagnostics, a whole lot of things that will enable you to say, this is the set of behaviors that we want in the future. Now, usually what happens with L&D is someone from the executive, the manager, whoever, operations comes to L&D and says, these people aren't doing their jobs well, can you train them, please? And so at some level, that person, that manager, has a feeling or more than a feeling that the change is needed for them to be able to guide those people towards executing the organizational strategy, doing whatever jobs they need to do. So really what you've got to do is tap into, well, that manager, that executive sponsor, what are the various things they've noticed? What are they using as an set of evidence criteria that means things aren't going or people aren't doing the things the way they want them to do them? So that's what you're tapping into. What's created this decision that we need to do any kind of learning anyway? So that's the first step. And that will start then help you define, well, where we're at and why and what measures have been used to kind of create a sense of disquiet about where we're at, a sense that the status quo just isn't going to work for us. We've got to do something different. And then you've got to start asking the generic question, well, what do you want to happen instead in terms of the way people are doing their jobs? And it's really important, how do they do their jobs? And that means you've got to start looking at the tasking that they are being tasked to do and what behaviors they will need to exhibit consistently to do those tasks well enough to execute the organizational strategy. And then what you can do is start thinking, well, given that particular behavior, I don't know, having a courageous conversation or something like that, feedback, what sorts of skills might they need to practice in order to be able to stitch those skills together into that behavioral output? In the way like a golfer might deconstruct their swing and practice different parts of it and then put them all together again to go and do the full swing. And then you can say, well, given that we want them to do that behavior in this way, and this is how we will notice that it's happening or not happening, what are the set of skills that are needed that they need to practice on a regular basis to get to the point where they can deliver that behavior reliably and consistently? And then what knowledge might they need in order to go practice those skills? And so in other words, and also at what level of knowledge? So this skill practiced at a basic level needs this little bit of basic knowledge, but in a couple of weeks time when they've done a bit of practice, they're going to be practicing at a higher level. We might need to drip feed a bit more knowledge in at that point. So this is how you start building up the sequence of activities that someone might need to do in order to get from the current way they're doing things to the new way you want them to do things. And that might last over a week or two, or it might last over months, even a year or two, depending on how complex it is that the behaviors are that you're trying to change. So that's kind of how you start building up your workflow. And you can also obviously then talk to people who've already made that journey and saying, well, you went from a newbie to this. How did that happen? What did you practice? What did you think? What are your beliefs around that? So you'd want to model excellence as well, if that's available to model. And then you can start thinking about all the little things they need to do along the way. Now, pretty clearly, there's always going to be some knowledge they're probably going to have to consume, some information they're going to have to be made aware of. So at what stage in that journey over, say, 3 or 4 months might they need those bits of knowledge? Don't add too much at the beginning because they'll just forget it. Add it in as and when they need it along that workflow. In the same way, you don't want to know at the start of your sat-nav journey all the stuff, you know, that you're going to pass along the way. You just want to know what's around the next corner and how to do that. You trust the journey. Then the other thing you've got to do is thinking, what are all the different turns and how are they going to make them? So, and by this, it's, well, one of those might be, obviously, it's about consuming a bit of content. Might be, look at this video, look at this bit of e-learning or whatever. But it also might be, now sit and reflect on how that matters to you in your particular context. It might be, go and experiment with these three methods of doing it to see which one works best for you. It might be, go and practice the method that works best for you 5 more times. Go and talk to 3 colleagues about this particular bit of information. Come together as a cohort and discuss your experiences of going along this journey on your own and then perhaps collaboratively and together. Go and create a little project that will enable you to practice this skill or this behavior in a safe environment and so on. So there's lots and lots of different activities that might pull together to make up this learning workflow journey, but you kind of don't know what those are until you know what the start point and end points are and you know the behaviors are. So the learning workflows can look very, very different depending on what the outcomes are. But fundamentally, they're made up of all of those little steps someone needs to take along the way. There's a lot more information about how you then decide on how to deliver those steps to them, you know, and also the calls to action for each step. You're then into the realm of choice architecture and a lot of other things. So there's some ways you can make these journeys work really, really well. And ways you can mess them up as well, you know. But ultimately, I kind of have taken the stance now that if someone's going to change their behavior in an organizational context, they have been through some kind of learning workflow, whether that was designed for them or whether they created it themselves or it kind of happened almost implicitly because of the situation they were in.
You've kind of just answered my next question on how you deliver those workflows, because it kind of makes sense that you've got that process and you've got those bits in there. What about if you've got bits that perhaps are a bit more flexible that don't necessarily sit beside that? Because I understand that you said that obviously you're going to have different points and different bits are going to come up. But what about if you could do things different ways? Because a sat nav, you go from A to B and you can have different routes and you can be diverted. That kind of makes sense because that's quite straightforward, if that makes sense. But when you're in work, sometimes you can go off and you can be diverted a million times and kind of come to the same B if you're starting at A. So how do you put that into a learning workflow when you could have lots of different tangents and bits that come off that? And how is that then delivered? Because it's not necessarily as simple as going from A to B.
Well, I think it happens because of the activities to set people. The next turn-by-turn instruction is go to the next roundabout and take the exit that looks the best one for you. There might be 50 exits off that roundabout. So yeah, it's not like we're saying you must take exit number three. We're saying to the learner, how is this going to work for you? So it's a very learner-centric approach to it. And then always when you're thinking about learning transfer and getting people to change the way they do things, their colleagues, peers, and immediate line manager are a critical part of that whole process. And so they would need support from there and at different levels, depending on obviously is what they're trying to get. So they will be able to get feedback from there, hopefully, and suggestions on, well, when I was a lad, I did it this way, you might try this yourself, you know. So we always recommend that someone going through a learning workflow has someone assigned to them to sort of shepherd them through it, to encourage them through it, to give them opportunities to practice and do things. So the environment within which they are operating as they go through that learning workflow has an impact on how successful it might be. And that environment usually is controlled by their line manager. So this is where you've got to start thinking, this is not just a learner on a journey. We need to keep it learner-centric, which is what L&D often doesn't do, by the way. It often does things to suit itself.
Yeah.
So let's focus on what matters for the learner in their particular context. And then one of the context factors they've got is their line manager. So with that line manager on board, then they can add in their own things. So in a way, that line manager can almost say, well, here's your generic journey. But as a line manager, I can customize that as it's delivered, while it's delivered. To add these little bits into the mix. So, okay, this activity is coming up this week. I suggest you try option B because that's going to work better for us here in R&D. And option A is going to work better for those guys over in logistics. You know, so there's ways you can set it up, which tends to give you that level of personalization, which I think kind of answers where you were going with that. Because yes, you're right. You will need that level of personalization.
Yeah, because I was just thinking about that. Would you perhaps break down those learning workflows so you'd have them maybe shorter so you are able to kind of like interchange them between? So if you are having to take a slightly different journey, would you break it down so you've got like smaller learning workflows so you can get through, like you said, the generic parts of it just fine. But if you have got like a nuanced bit, you can go off onto a different section or a different tangent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And certainly on our platform, you can assign multiple learning workflows to the same learner as they go through. So there's a whole lot of flexibility around that. But yes, you would certainly, you might have one on feedback, one on comm skills, one on, you know, whatever. And then they might all be part of a bigger one. So you can also multi-level it like that as well. So the bigger learning workflow is over this 2 years, you're on a graduate intake program. Here's our primary workflow for that entire graduate intake program over 2 years. But along the way, you will be doing these different mini workflows to feed into that. So that at the end of the 2 years, you've done your job swaps, you've done this, you've done all the bits required. And also, you can obviously bolt in the appropriate assessment along the way to make sure that someone has got to a level or a standard that you require them to be at. And this is critical where you're talking about things like in the NHS, for example, where We're working with them on things like care certificates and other aspects of so that when you go into a hospital, you know, the person treating you has actually been through some learning. They've looked at someone else do a job like draw blood. They've done it themselves. They've then actually done it under supervision. Then they've done it under observation to prove they can do it in the future without further adult supervision. So all of that can be built into the workflow, because if you think about it, they're all just tasks along that journey to get from where they were to someone fully certified to go and draw blood, for example. So you can build in all of those kind of measures and assessments, and this works really well for everything from, you know, various qualifications to apprenticeships and almost anything. All of them, when you think about it, are actually workflows, like sequences of activities you have to set up. And as soon as you set those things up as a sequence of activities, a lot of other benefits start flowing out of that that are not immediately apparent.
I think the point, you know, even talking about something like the care certificate shows where this can work really naturally and almost work within the way L&D is viewed in lots of organizations. So you come with a full solution, I can follow this, I don't really have to do that much. And what I mean by that is sometimes the relationship and responsibility between the learner, the line manager, other support people and the L&D team is sort of not in the right balance. And you know, people will think learning can be easy, I should just be able to come on and flow through something without taking, and we know that's wrong, but you will get organizations where managers don't want to put the effort in. You know, there isn't that culture of actually I've got to support my team, or the learner comes through and goes, well, you know, I've got to go off and do something myself. You know, you have those cultural businesses that I've worked in and worked with where that is that problem. And you know, you take something like the care certificate, it's, you know, thousands of people across the country are going through something like that. There's a sort of a set journey for it. But in a more nuanced role within an organization where you're trying to create that culture of, we'll create a path, but we can't be as prescriptive, and you're going to have to fill in the gaps, and you're going to have to take more of that load yourself as a learner, because like you said, you're designing get to the roundabout and work out which is the best for yourself with your line manager. You know, there's a whole load of cultural change. I can imagine some learning people sitting there and going, I'm going to get pushback. It may be the right thing to do, but I'm going to get pushback. How can I build the culture of being able to use learning workflows, you know, in a way that actually helps the business? Because there will be people who think that becomes too much work for line managers. And I'm not saying that's my view. I'm just saying I will have, you know, I have come across that challenge before, and I'm sure listeners will be coming across that challenge within their businesses as well.
I think, yeah, the line manager thing is interesting. I mean, it's in every line manager's job description, I would hope, that thou shalt develop thy team as one of their commandments, and many of them ignore that. And you're absolutely right. I see those cultures as well. And I think the putting learning workflows in place is a way to start changing that culture. So I also see it operating as a culture change tool in some organizations that it's been implemented in. And that's really interesting, because ultimately you do want those line managers involved in getting the best from their team. I mean, that's what a line manager's responsibility is for. I've got to do whatever I can to get the best out of my team. That's my role, whatever else I'm tasked with doing. So how can they do things for those people in the team? And you're not necessarily asking for very much. And it depends how you set the learning workflow up and the activities up as to what engagement level the line manager needs. But if a line manager is doing their job, they should be having relatively regular one-to-ones anyway with someone on the team, which should be strategic and developmental rather than tactical, which is what they often devolve into. So that developmental one-to-one that maybe should be happening once a week or once a fortnight at minimum, just while they're on a learning workflow, then they would work with whatever is extant at that moment in the learning workflow. So we're not necessarily asking line managers to put any more time in. And if they're not doing those one-to-ones, then actually that's a slightly different conversation you need to have with those line managers. And probably they need some training on how to be a manager, because there's something missing there. So I absolutely get that about pushback, but also what you'll find is that, and I was talking with another company just the other day, literally, where they're saying, well, if, you know, they didn't say this, but what I the subtext was, if we build it, they will come. In other words, if we put this content in place, people are going to come and run around and come and grab from this big smorgasbord of content and everything will be rosy. And I said, well, no, that's not going to happen. Primarily because the culture in that organization was, as you described earlier, where learning really wasn't a big thing for most people. If somebody already has a strong learning culture, that sort of thing will work. But in many organizations, that's not the case. And it certainly wasn't in this one. So we would started talking with them about, well, if you can, what you're trying to do is get people to jump from a largely spoon-fed L&D provision into a self-directed provision where then L&D becomes a curator and facilitator to help them with their self-directed learning. And that's a huge leap. And generally learners won't make that leap. And certainly they won't make it on their own in an organization with the learning cultures fighting that leap if they try and make it. So if you provide a learning workflow with a structure, you're kind of saying, here's the things you need to do. You're providing a halfway house between those two extremes of completely spoon-fed and self-directed. And the way you set the activities up, you can set them up to be either more self-directed type activities or less self-directed, more, you know, mandatory. So you can set that the instructions and activities up to suit the culture. As that evolved, you can obviously evolve the way that you design those activities. In the same way that if you have a SatNav journey, you might well plan differently depending on whether you've got a mini or a 10-ton truck. You know, you're going to need slightly different journeys depending on, you know, the environment around and the people making the journey. So yes, valid challenges that you've made, absolutely. And actually the learning workflow is a way to start dealing with those in a way that other approaches to L&D, you know, don't make. And particularly the approach where it's, well, we put all this nice content in place and then what? And then even if someone consumes that content and you can prove it because this data on the LMS still doesn't mean that it's been converted into action in any way, shape or form. You've got no visibility of that whatsoever. The only people that really have visibility are that person's immediate peers and their line managers. So you need to have them involved to some level in the process, even a light touch, to get visibility of what's really happening behaviorally out there after your L&D invention. So if you've got a learning workflow and you've been defining behaviors well and the measures that you might use to see if those behaviors are there or not, then you can start doing things as we've done on our platform. You can put a Kirkpatrick level 3 evaluation directly into your program. So you can look at, well, what are the observable behaviors at the beginning and what are the observable behaviors at the end of the program after, say, 6 months. And you can see, has the needle changed on those behaviors? But clearly, if you selected the right set of behaviors and you have moved the needle on the dial sufficiently, then you should see some results in terms of the KPIs and organizational strategy execution. If you don't see results at that level, probably you selected the wrong behaviors. So even if you deliver behaviors, you've got to be, you know, your diagnostics and initial thinking has to be good in order to make sure you're actually delivering the right behaviors that will have an impact business-wise.
Do you find people that are using your system, do you think that they are able to remove perhaps some of the other processes that kind of sit in the background? Because we talked about like managers having to do maybe a bit more, but does it actually remove that need? Because if they're able to analyze people's workflows and stuff like that, and I guess they can have conversations with them either via the platform or however you do that, are they able to, does that kind of remove the need for perhaps like appraisals and stuff like that? So are you reducing that or kind of adding to it? Like, how does that kind of work?
I don't think you're replacing some of what they do with some stuff that works a little better. I don't think overall you're reducing the load of someone's need to manage people in their team by any means. You still need some kind of appraisals process. But having said that, if they've been on a number of learning workflows over time, there's going to be a better rapport, we get that a lot, you know, where people say, well, actually my rapport with my manager is way better. And you know, I can go talk to them. I can raise issues much more freely than I ever used to. And the learning workflow has meant that we've developed conversations about stuff that we never would have talked about if it hadn't been. So I think it improves those relationships, but I don't think it would necessarily and probably shouldn't reduce the time spent by a manager on their people.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant in regards to kind of like more like technology and like that process bit around it. So you're not having to, because I could just imagine you could potentially duplicate stuff. So are people like your clients, are they reducing some of that? Still having the great conversation, still booked in weekly, bi-weekly, however often they do that, but and still having those good conversations that are prompted a bit better, but are they able to kind of take away perhaps like, I don't know, like an appraisal system or something like that? That's more kind of what my question was.
I don't know. It rather depends on how they want to do their appraisals or PDPs or whatever they want to call them. I mean, some companies live and breathe that stuff. Others are getting moving away from it a lot. It's really interesting how that's all shifting and changing. What we have talked with one company about, although we didn't, we haven't yet implemented, is they do their appraisal, and out of the appraisal meetings, since you mentioned appraisals, is you often get this little tick box sheet of, well, these are the three different training courses that this person needs to go on over the next 12 months, and you get this kind of, and then a third of those are funded, two thirds are not, and so on. So a lot of people don't get what they want anyway. Whereas if you had some kind of almost off-the-shelf learning workflows available, they could literally go on, okay, feedback skills has come up, let's get you on a learning workflow tomorrow and start your feedback skills learning workflow. And it's between that learner and the manager, and they go on to that workflow and deal with it rather than wait for a training course to come up and be funded. So I think it can actually improve what happens in that whole appraisals process, provided you're using appraisals to develop people rather than in a way they're often used, which is to beat them up at the end of the year and then decide if they get a bonus or not.
So,
I don't think it would necessarily say, well, if you have a learning workflow platform, you can dump the appraisals platform. It may be the way that's operated would be different and probably would be. So I think it would certainly have a knock-on effect elsewhere. And we've certainly seen that with some of our clients where they have switched some stuff off because they don't need it, because they're getting better visibility of what's happening anyway, particularly once it gets onto a digital platform. But it depends on what they've already got and where they are. But as always, as soon as you go digital, you end up with a bit more data that you can then use to decide, well, what's going on. And you can also then use that to look at about a higher level, who's struggling, you know, who's behind, who's not managing to keep up. And that means you can go find them, hopefully earlier rather than later. So an early radar warning system can say, well, those people, tap them on the shoulder and say, okay, you're obviously a little bit behind here. How can we help? Is this the right role for you even? You know, should we be working with you to move somewhere else in the organization and so on? So it can trigger a lot of those sorts of things, which otherwise might not, you know, be found out. People can hide in management roles very easily and then go and hide in meetings, and it can be years before you find out, well, actually they're never ready for it and don't really cut it. So, It's just there's so many different ways you can set them up. You know, that's the whole thing. And a lot of that will depend on the culture that you're setting it up, the way that managers currently operate. But also, of course, what you're doing along the way, if you get the managers involved, you're starting to teach those managers what good management looks like. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the learner that's benefiting. And we've had that sort of feedback from users as well. The managers are saying, this was brilliant, you know, it's been used for like onboarding, and the manager's saying, this is great, I don't have to have my own onboarding checklist, I just follow what the system says, I just know, well, what are we doing today, okay, here we go, you know. And it means a lot of consistency, so it is certainly saving people time in those kind of scenarios.
I think it's just my brain for trying to do things and workarounds and things like that, and just reducing stuff. That's what kind of prompted that question of like, if you did things like this, could you do it that way?
I think that's very dependent on what's there already in an organization. But yes, we certainly have seen that kind of thing happen where organizations, in fact, one we're working with right now, is turning off one of their systems in time once ours is more established there.
Yeah, Paul, a lot of what you've said really resonates with me. I think back, well over 20, 25 years when I was putting in a induction program into a retailer, and one of our goals was to get managers to talk to their teams, because there was a culture where There was such high turnover that managers didn't bother to talk to their team unless someone had made it through the first, you know, sort of 3 months, 6 months, then they became worth talking to and learning their name. No one had slightly twigged that that might be part of the turnover problem, but hey. So, you know, we created this sort of learning workflow again without the technology backing it. It was workbooks, manager's guide, set meetings, set tasks, but that worked really well in terms of creating that that journey that people could go through and setting, you know, that need and structure for managers around those conversations. And one of the things that was vitally important was to train the managers as well, and not, you know, train everyone around those transitions. But what also came out is around training the learning teams. And, you know, you talked about behavioral needs analysis and various different things. Sometimes if you are in that order taker mode, or you're not really used to pushing back and creating these journeys, what should a learning person be thinking about? Or, you know, how might they approach that if they're thinking, actually, what Paul said today really resonates and I should be doing more of that stuff? Where do they start?
I think many of them have already started, I'll be honest. Is then you just said it before, back when you were doing that, you were doing a sort of a learning workflow. You had a sequence of things that you were getting people to do, albeit you were doing it with email and spreadsheets and sort of more manually. So it's not that this is kind of a new thing that no one's ever done before. We've you know, even if you give people a couple of tasks to do as they leave the training room, that just is a little mini learning workflow, but usually inadequate to achieve what's being, you know, desired by doing that. So the first thing to think about is when you do give people tasks or activities on a learning workflow, those tasks ideally should be little small ones, because then they're much more likely for the person to actually do it right now. And as soon as you do that, you might be doing 3, 4, 5 tasks a week or something like that, just little ones that might take a few minutes each or whatever. But you build that up over some weeks and hundreds of users. You're talking thousands and thousands of tasks to deliver. So you've kind of got to go digital to do that. And that's one reason that people haven't done learning workflows well, is they haven't cottoned onto the fact that they need a workflow digital solution to do that. An LMS won't do it. And also, if you go and use any of the kind of more standard workflow solutions that are used for sort of running, I don't know, transactions through an insurance company or something like that, those don't work very well in a learning context. So that kind of idea of a learning workflow platform, or an LWP, there's another acronym for you. Woohoo, that's two in this session.
Collect them today.
Yeah, so an LWP or a learning workflow platform is really important as a way to deliver. So that's one of the things they need to be thinking about, is if we structure this learning workflow well with lots of little mini activities spread over time, we're going to have to go digital to deliver it at scale in any way, shape or form. They also need to be realizing that there that some and you talked about the order taker thing, which is kind of right, but it depends on how big the organization is. If you have a larger organization with a larger L&D population, 50 people or something, then actually the people in the middle of that L&D organization should be order takers. They shouldn't be anything else. It's the people at the edge of that L&D organization who are interacting direct with the company and taking the orders that need to be pushing back. And well, not so much pushing back, but having those performance diagnostics and behavioral needs analysis conversations. And then they then push the order that's now been filtered and made a good order into the L&D. So design this workflow to go and achieve this goal. And you might need to go and talk with the company, that, you know, people out there in operations to do it. But it is an L&D person who's doing designing a learning intervention, and they should be taking that order. So not everyone in L&D should be in this role where they're being made to feel embarrassed because they're not pushing back when they get an order. So I think we've got to be a bit careful how we tar people with that particular brush. But there absolutely needs to be this kind of filter on the edge. It's almost like L&D is a cell within the greater multicellular body, but the cell wall around L&D needs to be impermeable to stupid requests for training. There needs to be some kind of filter at that point. And that's where that performance diagnostics, where the performance consultancy, where the behavioral needs analysis takes place. And that's the initial steps in the design. And then the order gets pushed into the L&D section proper. Now, in a small company, that's going to all be the same person or same little team of a few people. So, yes, they should all push back against the order. But that's that's going to be the process, is there's that initial engagement. And yes, L&D people will probably need some help to think about that. I mean, my second book has a lot of stuff on that, that whole performance consultancy conversation. And there's other good authors around that area too, people like Kathy Moore and Nigel Harrison. So, but that process, and I think now that I've been thinking more about learning workflows, I've realized that actually that behavioral needs analysis is a lot more critical than perhaps I used to think of it as. So getting clarity on the way that executive sponsor measures things in order to develop their gut feel that something's required in the first place. Because ultimately, when that executive sponsor or whoever signs the check, they are going to use that same set of internal criteria they have to judge whether the program was a success. Even if those criteria they're using are not that useful, really, from a learning or performance perspective, they're going to have their own set of internal stuff that they're using. So you've got to get clear with them, well, how are you judging the fact that we currently have a need or a problem? So there's a need, I think, to get people up to speed with that. And it's a consultancy process. I mean, any decent consultant can do it. It's nothing, you know, untoward. It's just, but it's much more consultative than what L&D perhaps is used to doing, in the sense that performance consultancy or performance diagnostics or behavioral needs analysis, whatever you want to call it, or however you get there, is a first step that does not presuppose that learning is the desired solution that's going to solve this problem. And we've got to separate that from what I term learning consultancy, which is what the learning professional will do once they receive the order to create that program. But until someone's been through that initial stage, the performance consultancy, the things that need to be done at the edge of L&D, where it interfaces with the business, when that step's done, then there is no presupposition that learning will be a solution. And it may well be that the manager asking for learning goes away realizing that learning is not going to work for them, that the reason that people aren't behaving well is there's a systemic problem, or the spare parts aren't available, or there's something wrong with some other IT system, or whatever it is. And they will go away realizing that actually L&D can't fix this, or it might be a very small part of a bigger solution, in which case L&D can contribute, but actually project management wise, it shouldn't be L&D managing that project, and so on. So there's that whole sense of the different stages of that process of going
I think there's a lot of complexity around almost behavior diagnosis as well, and identifying those key behaviors, because I think we almost talk about this as these are the behaviors that you need to exhibit to succeed. I think that's sometimes oversimplified even in that one sentence, because I was reading something about coaching in sport and how they were looking at, you know, the passing accuracy of football players, and looking at analyzing how much someone was scanning the pitch. So, you know, were they, when they received the ball, effectively, were they situationally aware of what was going on around them? And did that then lead to, you know, greater passing accuracy and ball retention and whatever? So they're looking at some fairly logical steps to do that. But there was so much noise around the edges of, was that a key criteria or was it not? Was that a behavior that they should be investing time into scanning, or was it actually about the confidence of the player to, you know, believe? And there were so many different behaviors and views mixed up in there that sometimes I think when we're in that diagnosis process and we're talking about a behavioral needs analysis, getting down to what are the behaviors that are really going to make the difference in that business for those individuals across a mass set of people can be oversimplified. We need to build their confidence. We need to do this. And we don't really go deep enough into those things to then build a platform to take them in that direction we need to, whatever that platform is, if it's a learning workflow, or whatever else. That to me is something that sometimes we just skirt around a little bit in learning.
I think that's true, but there is a way to do it, and that's to focus on the measurable results of that behavior rather than the behavior itself. So you define it by the way you measure it, and that's going to be observable, and that's either going to be observing the behavior directly. So you used a football example. I can relate to that. I played, when I was a much younger, basketball at a very high level, even internationally, and we had the same concept of when you're on the court, your awareness of where your teammates were and where the opposing teammates were. And I remember one guy on my team never looked around, but he knew where people were, got some kind of sixth sense. So if you looked at him saying, is he looking around the court? You'd say, well, no. But he'd throw the ball over his left shoulder behind him and it would go directly, unerringly to a teammate. So he knew where that person was. So what you've got to do is look at either the directly observable behavior or what I call the first order effects of that behavior. So for example, that pass over his shoulder where he wasn't watching but knew where that person was, that's a first order effect. In other words, it was a successful and accurate pass at the right time. So even though he wasn't looking around the court, which is the observable behavior, there was a first order effect that proves that he was able to do what was required. So that was very much around, not the behavior wasn't so much being aware of teammates, the behavior is much more about accurately passing the ball when it was required to do so. So that's the behavior you need to be tracking and perhaps measuring. So it's also being clear about how will I know when that behavior is occurring? And that's about talking to the various stakeholders, thinking, well, they're not doing it now. How do you know they're not doing it now? So they're already using some set of measures. So how will those measures change when they start doing it? So that's how you approach that. So I agree with you, you can oversimplify, but I think if you approach it from how you would observe those behaviors, either in a first order or second order effect, then you can start getting really clear about what's happening. Plus it also gives you a set of measures. And of course, if you're putting any kind of learning in place and you don't have a set of viable measures, you're kind of a bit crazy anyway. So really what you're saying is, as we do the behavioral needs analysis, if we do it right, we will be developing a set of measures that we can then use to judge our success in delivering these behaviors to the organization. It requires a subtle shift in thinking, but it's not major. It is just, it's a mindset shift rather than a whole new skill set. L&D people can do this. It's just they've got to think a little differently and get away from this idea of the learning objective is to understand X, Y, Z. Well, actually, I hate that word, understand the learning objectives. It doesn't mean anything. So you've got to get clear. The learning objective is so that what we will see is, or people will be doing, not be able to do, but be doing. So there's some subtle differences in how you word your objectives that will get you there. Anyway, you're quite right, and there are ways to deal with that.
No, and I think that, you know, talking, and I think that's where people fall into the gap, is because someone would observe your teammate who seemingly doesn't look anywhere, and they'd be trying to work out, well, the secret sauce for him is he doesn't look anywhere, so therefore we're going to train everyone to not look anywhere because that's going to work for everyone. I think that's where people get into trying to, rather than build, you know, as we said, the outcome is, you know, accurate passes or ball retention or whatever is the outcome for your business, sales completed. People get so into those, trying to re-engineer that process so that it's the same for everyone, but not accepting that we're people, we're nuanced. So, you know, the way of me, you or Katie getting from A to B might be slightly different along that journey, and that, you know, having a workflow that allows us to go in that way and develop our uniqueness. And I think it's that sometimes people think it's got to be very linear and then therefore don't build the nuance and the subtlety into those learning workflows, and it just becomes a one size fits all procession that doesn't get people to where they need to be.
We found they still work pretty well even when they're not that well designed. Really, I mean, it's surprising. So we've got people have built workflows on our system, and I look at them, I think, well, actually, there's so much room for improvement, but actually, they're still working. You know, so because there is a bit of time involved if you're going to do all that nuance and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And what we generally find is people evolve what they do as they start to realize how much power is there in doing it well. But that can take a little bit of time, you know, a few months as they start bedding it in, getting some results back and seeing how people interact with it. And also seeing how what they've built interacts with the culture that's out there that people are operating within while they are doing the learning workflow. That cultural soup they're swimming in is such a big factor in, well, all learning, quite frankly. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you very much, Paul. I think we could talk for quite a while and it could be a very long podcast. So I think we'll kind of draw a line on it there. But thank you very much for joining us today. If any of our listeners want to get in touch with you or ask you any questions, what do they need to do?
The easiest thing is probably my LinkedIn profile. It's just look Paul Matthews on LinkedIn. And then they can also obviously find us on our platform at peoplealchemy.com. And I have a personal website as well at paul-matthews.com, and they can go there, and there's lots of blogs on this kind of stuff. There's videos, there's interviews I've done, links to podcasts like this one that I've done with other people around these topics. So either of those websites, peoplealchemy.com or paul-matthews.com. And they're on my LinkedIn profile. So do link up on LinkedIn, and if you want to ask any questions, I'm very happy to answer. I love talking about this stuff, and I think it's just great for the sector. So you know, I'm not trying to hide anything. I'd rather get it out there and help people make useful changes, whether they use our platform or not. It's kind of be fun if they did, but you know, hey, let's just make a change, because I think L&D has a huge lever it can pull that it's not aware of, and I'd rather love to help people pull it more to get better results for everyone.
Oh, most definitely. No, we really appreciate you joining us today. And we'll put those links in the show notes below so people can get in touch with you as well. So thank you very much.
Cool. Yep. Thank you, Paul.
All the best. Happy heat wave, as they say at the moment.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can register to join the Learning Effect community. The link to do so is in the show notes below. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if the Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.